This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This place.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
If our federal government tells the state of Arizona you can have the law, we are not detaining, we are not processing, we are not accessing your law, then it is moot. And I think that is the next step, is a non-cooperation.
Arizona Congressmember Raul Grijalva. He's calling on President Obama to fight a new law in Arizona that's being described as the harshest anti-immigrant measure in the country. Grijalva will join us from Capitol Hill. We'll also speak with veteran Mexico reporter John Ross about his latest book, El Monstruo, Dread and Redemption in Mexico City. But first, an interview with James Cameron, the Academy Award-winning filmmaker and director of Avatar, the highest-grossing movie of all time. He joins us to talk about Avatar being embraced by indigenous people worldwide, last week's People's Climate Summit in Bolivia, and his plans for an Avatar sequel.
For me, the responsibility in a subsequent film is going to be to take what I've learned now that I'm involved with a lot of these people, with these leaders and with these cultures, take what I've learned, take their issues, and incorporate them into the next film in a way that's meaningful.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Republicans blocked the financial reform bill from reaching the Senate floor Monday as Democrats fell 3 votes short of the 60 needed to bring the measure up for debate. Although the result was expected, Democratic Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska surprised some by joining Republicans in opposition. Another vote is expected later in the week as talks continue on reaching a bipartisan deal. Before the vote, the bill's lead sponsor, Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut, touted the proposed Consumer Protection Agency.
Where do you go to get a recall on a faulty mortgage or a credit card deal that's corrupt or fraudulent or deceptive or abusive? Why shouldn't we deal with financial products that can bring you to financial ruin if we can't address them? And yet you can do it with a toaster, a TV, or an automobile. Our bill sets up a Consumer Financial Product Safety Commission Bureau Division that we've established in this bill so that consumers themselves can have some place to go to get redress. Rules can be written to protect them against abusive practices.
A new Washington Post ABC News poll, meanwhile, shows 2/3 of Americans support a financial overhaul that would restrict the activities of banks and other major financial firms. Executives from the bailed-out Wall Street giant Goldman Sachs are appearing before a Senate hearing today amidst increasing scrutiny on their practices. On Monday, the Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations said Goldman's alleged unlawful activities extended beyond the single mortgage-related securities case that led to civil fraud charges earlier this month. Subcommittee Chair Senator Carl Levin of Michigan held up copies of emails he says proves that Goldman devised not just one, but a number of complex deals that resulted in a $3.7 billion in earnings for the company. Investigators say Goldman's tactics centered around making negative bets or shorts that profited from the housing market's collapse. The U.S. has extradited the former Panamanian president and CIA asset Manuel Noriega to France for trial on money laundering charges. Noriega has been jailed in Miami since 1990 after his overthrow in the U.S. invasion of Panama that killed up to 3,000 people. Noriega's drug trafficking sentence ended 2 years ago, but he's remained in jail while fighting France's extradition request. Noriega's attorney, Frank Rubino, criticized the U.S. for failing to inform him of Noriega's extradition.
We have had no official recognition whatsoever. We've heard from the press, and you folks tell us that he's on a plane to France as we speak.
Is that normal practice?
No, usually the government has and does things in a more professional manner and respects common courtesy, and we're shocked that they didn't.
Now,
I'm surprised that they just didn't put a black hood over his head and drag him out in the middle of the night.
Noriega was previously a close U.S. ally and a paid CIA informant, despite known ties to drug trafficking. The Reagan administration turned against him in the mid-1980s after Noriega became less cooperative in the U.S. war on the Nicaraguan government and on efforts to retain effective control over the Panama Canal. In Israel and the occupied territories, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has signed an order barring Palestinians from working in Israeli settlements and selling settlement goods. It's unclear if the order will apply to the estimated 30,000 Palestinians who currently work in Israeli settlements or just those who would seek future employment. A new study released on the 24th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster says the death toll is far higher than previously thought. In a book published by the New York Academy of Sciences, a Russian author and a Belarusian author say nearly 1 million people have died from exposure to radiation released by the Chernobyl reactor. According to the book, the disaster's radioactive emissions may have been 200 times greater than the initial estimate of 50 million curies and hundreds of times larger than the radioactivity from the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The authors base their findings in part on Slavic sources they say have never been available in English. In Mexico, President Felipe Calderón has denounced a new Arizona law that forces police officers to determine the immigration status of someone they suspect of being an undocumented immigrant. Republican Governor Jan Brewer signed the bill on Friday following its approval in the state legislature earlier in the week. Opponents call it the harshest anti-immigrant measure in the country and a license for racial profiling. On Monday, Calderón said the measure will breed racial discrimination.
A legislation which opens the door to unacceptable racial discrimination is set in motion. Mexico's government will use everything in its power to defend the rights of Mexicans who are affected by this legislation, and will spare no effort to ensure the dignity of every fellow compatriot.
The law's passage has spurred calls for a boycott of Arizona's economy. We'll have more on the Arizona immigration law with Congressmember Raul Grijalva later in the broadcast. The oil spill from last week's oil rig explosion off the Louisiana coast has grown to cover 1,900 square miles of the Gulf of Mexico. The U.S. Coast Guard and crews hired by the rig's operator, BP, are struggling to contain the spill. The underwater well where the rig exploded continues to leak around 42,000 gallons of oil a day. Ed Levine of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration said at least some of the oil will reach the Gulf Coast shoreline.
There will be shoreline impacts from this eventually. There's no way that we will pick up all the oil that's being released.
11 workers remain missing since the explosion and are presumed dead. The wife of one of the missing workers, Natalie Rashto, has filed a lawsuit accusing BP of negligence in operating the rig. The suit also names the oil services giant Halliburton, which performed work on the well before the explosion. A young U.S. citizen has been held in 23-hour solitary confinement for nearly 3 years, set to go on trial Wednesday. He's here in New York. Syed Fahad Hashmi is charged with providing material support to al-Qaeda in a case that rests on the testimony and actions of an old acquaintance who turned government informant after his own arrest. Hashmi is being prosecuted for a 2-week period when the informant stayed at his home carrying rain gear that was allegedly later delivered to al-Qaeda members in Pakistan. Hashmi's period in solitary confinement is believed to be one of the longest ever for a prisoner before trial. On Monday, Hashmi's supporters held a rally to draw attention to his case. Hashmi's brother, Faisal Hashmi, said he has no hope for a fair trial.
No, he's already lost the fair trial portion. The concept of fair trial is lost. What we're trying to do is work to highlight what's going on in his case, and we hope that the people in the jury can see through this facade of justice.
Hashmi's supporters say they plan to continue weekly vigils throughout the trial. And a federal appeals court has upheld a class action lawsuit against the retail giant Walmart alleging gender discrimination against female employees. In a 6-5 decision, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco ruled hundreds of thousands of female Walmart employees can sue the company as a single class over allegations they received lower pay and less promotions than male co-workers. The case could mark the largest class action employment discrimination suit in U.S. history. Walmart has sought to have each case tried individually and says it will appeal to the Supreme Court. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadous.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. On the heels of his record-setting Hollywood blockbuster Avatar, the film director James Cameron is taking on a new role as an activist. Since its release last year, Avatar has become the highest-grossing movie of all time, topping only Cameron's previous film, Titanic. Avatar centers around an indigenous species called the Na'vi, who resist the private military force of a powerful corporation trying to mine a valuable mineral on the Na'vi's planet of Pandora. Well, in real life, Cameron is now allying himself with indigenous struggles he says mirror the story told in his film. This weekend, James Cameron attended the ninth session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues here in New York, along with hundreds of indigenous activists from around the world. He had just returned from Brazil, where he joined protests against construction of the Belo Monte Dam, which opponents say will devastate indigenous communities in the Amazon rainforest.
Well, Democracy Now! Producer Aaron Mate caught up with James Cameron just after he appeared on a panel with indigenous leaders called Real Life Pandoras on Earth, Indigenous Peoples' Urgent Struggles for Survival. Cameron discussed his thoughts on last week's People's Climate Summit in Bolivia, his plans for an Avatar sequel, and his reaction to seeing Avatar embraced by indigenous people worldwide, from the Amazon to the occupied territories. And you don't even have to wear 3D glasses to watch this or even listen.
The success of Avatar triggered an interesting chain reaction, which is a lot of groups that are involved with indigenous issues and the environment and energy and so on have come to me saying, you know, how can we use the success of the film to continue to raise awareness? Not just a generalized kind of emotional reaction, but a very specific awareness on different battles that are in progress right now around the world. And I thought, well, okay, fine, this is an opportunity to maybe do some good beyond just the film itself. I mean, I thought, you know, as a filmmaker, as an artist, I put my story out there, you know, and people react to it and they draw their own conclusions. And that's it for me. I'm over and out, you know. But I don't think that's enough in this situation because Avatar doesn't teach you anything specific. It only gives you an emotional reaction, a sense of moral outrage, if you will, about the destruction of nature, about the, you know, destruction of indigenous people, culture, and so on. So I think people need action items. You know, they need specific things. They need specific information about what's going on, and they need specific action items about what to do about it. So you got to talk about it. There's got to be a dialogue. So I think there's a whole dialogue going on now in the wake of this film that's beneficial.
When you made the film, was this your intention all along to spark this kind of dialogue? What inspired you to make it?
I don't think I could have predicted what's happening right now. I mean, you always think, okay, you make a film, heart is in the right place, and that sort of goes out into the zeitgeist, and maybe it tips the tide very slightly in human consciousness, into tiny, you know, millionth. What I didn't expect was the success of the film, which I think is it's less about the film than about the need for people to see something like that in their entertainment, the need for them to have some kind of cathartic experience in a movie theater. And most entertainment doesn't give them that. And there was a lot of controversy, of course, as we were making the film about how much message should be in the movie. And I said, guys, you know, I'm talking to the people putting up the money. You know, I made this movie to make these statements because these things are important to me, which goes to the second part of your question. This movie started for me when I was a kid, you know, roaming around in the woods behind, you know, my little village in Canada where I grew up, and you know, feeling that incredible connection to nature, and then feeling it on an ongoing basis as an adult, as a scuba diver, and you know, seeing, you know, these incredible coral reef, ecosystems, with, just this amazing profusion and abundance of life, and not wanting to see it destroyed and degraded in the way that we are kind of inexorably doing as a technological civilization.
You were just in Brazil, helping bring awareness to a very large dam project. Can you talk about what you saw there?
Yeah, now Brazil, this is a case where I debated whether I should drill down to a specific issue, to a specific battle, or just talk more in sort of global generalities. And I was convinced by my friends at Amazon Watch that this is actually a pivotal battle, that not only in and of itself is important, but is important kind of symbolically and as a kind of a gateway almost to a whole bunch of other very similar projects that are going to devastate the entire Amazon basin. So I did get involved in the Belo Monte Dam issue. I went out into the forest. I attended, we went out by boat 10 hours, 12 hours. We took a couple of trips. Was involved in these big council circle meetings with leaders who had come in from all points of the compass, lots of different tribes. There were Arara, Juruna, Xikrin, Kayapo, Chipaya. There were, about 40 leaders at each of these two big meetings that we attended a few weeks apart. And their themes were almost the same, almost to a man, that we're gonna fight. We're going to die if necessary. We'll fight to the last drop of blood. This land is what we have. It's our life. The river's our life. All of these things. This dam project will displace 25,000 indigenous people. And there's no plan for where they go. They just get shoved out of the way. And the government doesn't want to talk to them. They're promised by law, hearings and things like that. The hearings didn't take place. And so on. They have no voice in the process, and the process is not transparent to the public. In fact, the public down there are being lied to. You can appreciate Brazil is rapidly developing. Its economy is rapidly developing. Its economy is growing very fast, and they're running out of power. So you have blackouts and brownouts in the big cities like São Paulo and Rio and so on. So the government tells the urban Brazilians, you're going to get power. We're building a dam. And so they say, they kind of shrug and say, well, that's a good idea. Except the power from the dam is not going to go to them. The dam's 1,500 miles away. The power is going to go to aluminum smelters. Aluminum smelters are incredibly energy intensive. And they make very, very few jobs per megawatt. So it's really a bum deal. Plus the profits go offshore. So you've got the Brazilian taxpayers subsidizing an 11 gigawatt dam project. They don't get the power. The dam itself is a very kind of shaky concept.
There was just a people's summit in Bolivia this past week, and they came out with a very strong declaration with several demands, including climate debt to countries affected by global warming, a call for a climate justice tribunal. What are your thoughts on this summit?
We absolutely need exactly those things. We have to acknowledge climate debt. Unfortunately, people don't want to hear this in this country because we're in a recession and we were dealing with this huge deficit, But there's an unseen deficit that we're creating today, and it's the cost of mitigating, global warming. People in this country don't even want to admit that global warming is real. We're behind most of the other developed nations in that regard. People just have sort of pulled the covers back over their head. It's crazy. We've gone from 47% of Americans believing that global warming is real and anthropogenically caused to 34%. We've gone from half to a third. So if you assume that of that enlightened third, half of them a small percentage of them are willing to actually do something about it, that's just not enough people to fight the fight. So not enough is happening. People need to be convinced that the problem is real. So these types of threats and these kinds of declarations are very, very critical in raising consciousness and getting it into a format that starts to become a precursor to law, to legislation and policy at an international level. It's got to happen.
You were honored today by some indigenous activists from Ecuador. What's it been like for you to have your film embraced by indigenous peoces?
It's certainly unbelievably moving to hear that kind of response. It's worth more to me than any Academy Award or Directors Guild Award or anything else. And that's not just sour grapes. It's literally, you know, the most important thing, because you know you're communicating. Now, you know, I didn't grow up as, you know, as an indigenous person living in the rainforest. I got it all from National Geographic magazine and from, you know, reading books on anthropology and so on and studying the value system and just, you know, my own kind of creative instincts as a writer. So we created a fantasy rainforest. And because it's at a remove, because it's fantasy, it wasn't shot in any one place. Everybody everywhere who's in a similar situation can project themselves into it. They say, oh, that's me. You know, this fantasy story is actually my life. That's happening to me now. I'm under pressure. My people are being displaced. Our lives are being degraded in some way. Whereas if I had just gone in and done a study of one individual people, you know, the others would have said, well, that's similar to me, but it's somehow not as moving to them. So, you know, it's been an amazing, amazing experience where so many people have, you know, come to me with this kind of response. That you know, it's fulfilling as an artist, but it's also very challenging as a human being, because their fight is real. And a lot of what I thought I was doing with this movie was commenting on the colonial period, the manifest destiny period in American history, so much of which is in the past. And, you know, we don't have the cavalry charging in and you know, cutting down whole villages now. You know, we think we've evolved beyond that, when in fact it is happening in other countries. You know, and there have been incidents in Peru just recently where you know, guns were used on protesting indigenous people who fought back with bows and arrows, and deaths on both sides, you know. So in order to you know, forestall, you know, future violence and bloodshed, you know, we have to be having this dialogue, because these people are informed enough now in this world of you know, rapid spread of information. They're informed enough to know that they have a legal basis. They certainly have a moral and ethical basis for their fight, but they also have a legal basis, so they're fighting back.
The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan seem to be an undercurrent of your movie.
Sure.
Were you making a commentary there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, clearly. Because, you know, I feel that this whole climate change thing is never really going to get solved unless we really have full cost accounting and we fully burden the cost of what we're doing. And by what we're doing, I mean burning fossil fuels and so on. And if you don't see that the cost of gas isn't $3 a gallon, that it's, you know, $10 or $15 a gallon, when you pay for all the military actions necessary to secure our oil supply lines and to secure our way of consuming energy here in North America, that's what you're paying for. You know, it's just this invisible tax, and we're all paying it. And you know, I mean, I'm a Canadian citizen, but I live in the U.S. and I pay taxes here, and you know, so I'm helping to pay for the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. And why are we there militarily? Oh yeah, sure, because we got attacked. Why did we get attacked? Because we've been messing around in the Middle East, you know, the Middle East region since the 30s. You know, pulling, you know, spending billions of dollars a day there, you know, in energy, and you know, we're dependent on it. You know, what, 70% of our oil comes from offshore sources. We're dependent on it. This nation would grind to a stop. So, you know, we put ourselves into a situation where we have to take these unethical military actions. Well, I consider Iraq unethical anyway. Afghanistan was a little more righteous because that was, you know, direct response to an attack. But the point is, why are we putting ourselves in that situation in the first place? We spent all this money on military action to preserve, you know, to preserve the flow of oil to ourselves. And you know, so to me, it always goes back to energy. It always loops back to energy and our really almost complete lack of a coherent energy policy in this country.
Now, you mentioned you're from Canada, you have citizenship from Canada. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, you haven't taken up U.S. citizenship.
No.
Can you tell us why?
Yeah, I actually had thought about it, and after the 2004 election, I decided not to.
With the election of President Bush.
You got it. Yeah, absolutely. I don't need to say any more on that, though, I don't think. That was my little act of protest.
When you saw Palestinians dressed up as the Navi, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, obviously, they're responding to their sense of being oppressed by saying, okay, guys, if everybody in the world can relate to the Na'vi, you know, being crushed by a large force, then you can see that we're in the same situation. I need to go spend some time there and really look at both sides of that issue. I'm not going to weigh in on that because I'm not an expert. I'm not an expert on that region. I'm not an expert at anything except making movies, really. But I have studied some of these other issues with respect to energy and indigenous rights, and it's a little bit different there because you're not dealing with the wholesale displacement of people out in the rainforest for the purposes of the continued economic growth. I think it's a little bit different. But again, I don't want to weigh in on that until I know more.
There seems to be some references with the light and the colors in your movie to the medicinal aspects of indigenous life. Are you making any kind of references to alternative medicine that people in the West might not be exposed to?
I think that really what I'm trying to do with the design in the film is to try to touch a kind of a mystical or spiritual aspect to the indigenous worldview, you know, and value system. The ones that are undisturbed, that are really uncontaminated by Western civilization, really believe things quite fundamentally differently than we do. They really believe their connection to the flow of the cycles of energy in their world. And I actually heard it expressed by an indigenous leader today that here in our technical society, we think of life as a line, and they think of it as a circle. And when you think of life as a line, you don't worry about what's behind you, you know, and what you leave behind, you know. But if you think of it as a circle, then you take responsibility for the future generations. And it's the seventh generation concept, you know. And they have a very interesting expression, which is, tread softly upon the earth because the faces of the unborn look up at you. Which, if everybody just thought that, they would do things very differently. You know, the industrialists, the CEOs, our political leaders, they have children, you know. They need to. They have a conscience. They have a heart. You know, some of them, probably the majority, actually. But unfortunately, they also have a kind of mandate from market forces to do their jobs a certain way, and people are going to have to break out of that cycle. You know, for me, the responsibility in a subsequent film is going to be to take what I've learned now that I'm involved with a lot of these people, with these leaders and with these cultures, take what I've learned, take their issues, and incorporate them into the next film in a way that's meaningful.
James Cameron, thank you very much.
The film director James Cameron, whose movie Avatar is the number one grossing movie of all time. He was speaking while attending the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues here in New York. Special thanks to John Gerberg and Hani Massoud. He was interviewed by Democracy Now!'s Aaron Mate. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
The news, uninterrupted, on WBAI. No sports, no weather, no commercials, no distractions. Just the facts on the award-winning WBAI Evening News, uninterrupted, daily at 6 and 11 on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, Pacifica, radio for a change.
Hi, my name is Letty. When I'm in New York, I always have my radio tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM. And when I'm back home in France, I listen on the web at wbai.org. Prata brilhando.
the late Elise Regina singing Aguash Damasu here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadous.
In Mexico, every 48 minutes, someone is killed in the so-called drug war. This according to the national Mexican newspaper El Universal. A new internal report by the Mexican government recently found that nearly 23,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence in Mexico since a U.S.-backed military crackdown on cartels began more than 3 years ago. The death toll rises each year. In the first 3 months of 2010 alone, more than 3,300 people have been killed.
Well, our next guest argues the U.S.-backed war on drugs needs to end. John Ross is an independent reporter, an activist, a poet. He writes, quote, billions have been wantonly flushed down the drain since Reagan's declaration of war in 1985, and the W word has become a much larger business. Those of us who have opposed every U.S. war from Vietnam to Afghanistan must demand an end to the White House's war on drugs. John Ross has been covering social movements in Mexico and Latin America for nearly 50 years. He's the author of 10 books. His latest is called El Monstro, Dread and Redemption in Mexico City. John Ross joins us here in our Democracy Now! Studio up from Mexico City. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Why the title,
El Monstro?
El Monstro, because Mexico City is a monster of a city, the largest megalopolis in Americas and possibly in the world. 23 million people living on a piece of land that does not really support them, where there is no water, where there is very bad air, nowhere. And their struggle to stay on this land, I think, has been epic. And the city is a monstro in itself. The Aztecs actually characterized the beginnings of El Monstro, it was called Tenochtitlan, as an animal itself. And as the population grew, it acquired this name, El Monstro. But it's our querido monstro, it's our beloved monstro, and this new book is really a defensive place of a totally indefensible place.
And you moved to Mexico City in 1985, soon after the massive 8.1 magnitude earthquake that devastated the city. Talk about how that earthquake affected Mexico City.
Sure. I actually had spent a lot of my misspent youth in Mexico and was working in the Southern Cone, dealing with guerrilla organizations in the Andes when the earthquake occurred on September 19th, 1985. And I was working for Pacific News Service, and I was asked to go back into Mexico and follow what happened, the aftermath of the earthquake, because earthquakes all throughout Latin America have shaken up the social structures in those countries, Nicaragua in 72, Peru in 70, and indeed Mexico is no exception. I arrived 1 week after the earthquake on September 26th and settled into an old creepy hotel in the Centro Histórico where I still live and became part of a movement of earthquake victims, damnificados, that organized a movement from which the civil society resurged in Mexico, a very resurgent civil society. That movement evolved from the individual. Each building was an organization unto itself. Each block was an organization. Each neighborhood was an organization. Within 3 weeks, we had put 100,000 people in front of the Mexican White House, Los Pinos. And with that pressure from down below, replacement housing, precisely where the housing had come down, 30,000 people were killed. Over 10,000 buildings damaged, 1,000 came down. But replacement housing was built exactly where it had come down due to the pressure from down below. And that movement of damnificados, that movement of earthquake victims, very quickly translated into political terms. And the government was very inactive at the beginning, and people suddenly realized they could take care of their own lives. They didn't have to depend on this party that had ruled Mexico for, at that point, 61 years, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the PRI. And one of my compadres, Don Lalo, said to me, you know, John, before the earthquake, we thought the PRI would take care of us from the cradle to the grave. And afterwards, we realized that we could do it for ourselves. And that sense actually translated into, as I said, political terms, the 1988 election, which was stolen from Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas. And the left actually and never has lost Mexico City since 1988. And when elections for the mayor were instituted as a result of constitutional reform in 1996 and 1997, Cardenas became mayor of Mexico City, elected mayor, and there have been four mayors since then. All of them from the Party of the Democratic Revolution. No other megalopolis in the Americas and perhaps in the world has been run by a left party for so long. It's been an interesting experiment.
Would you say Mexico City is where Subcomandante Marcos came from?
Subcomandante Marcos, who we haven't seen for a long time, is actually from Tampico in the north, in the state of Tamaulipas. He went to the Autonomous University, to the UNAM.
In Mexico City.
In Mexico City. And then
What was his name?
Well, Marcos has never told us what his name is. The government has said it repeatedly. Rafael Sebastian Guillen Vicente. We haven't seen him for a long time. He's been absent from the public stage for the last 14 months, although there have been periods of time when he's been absent longer, you know. But at this point, he didn't show up at the annual January 1st fiestas that occur as a result to mark the 16th year of the rebellion. And I have a feeling that Marcos is just the persona. He's just the mask. And I have a feeling that that persona no longer fits the needs of the Zapatista movement. We may not see Subcomandante Marcos again. No.
Well, you just said there's never been a left party that has run a major city for so long. What's changed?
A lot of things have changed. There were a lot of things to change. One of the things that I think has changed most radically is that the sense of community participation, the sense of citizen involvement, is the way things happen now. I go to two neighborhood meetings each week in the Centro, where I live. Hundreds of people come to these meetings and discuss what's going on in the city, discuss what's going on nationally, discuss what's going on in history, because this is the 100th anniversary of the Mexican Revolution. So, you know, these are get-togethers in which the people know that the input in these meetings will be heard at City Hall, just a couple of blocks away, as a matter of fact. So I think that's what's really changed. But in terms of social amenities, 13 years of a left party, things like abortion on demand during the first 12 weeks of gestation, free abortion on demand, same-sex marriage as of March 4th, and now every week we're having collective marriages, a right-to-die bill with dignity, bicycling every Sunday, 2 days a week without cars. The air has gotten better. The gas has been reformulated. Commitment to recycling. Mexico puts out about 20,000 tons of garbage every day, and that's a lot of recycling to be done. All of these social amenities, they're very distinct from the rest of Mexico and very distinct from the rest of Latin America. And sometimes it feels like Mexico City is San Francisco, you know. Those kind of things have changed, you know.
John, why did you move to Mexico City?
I came in right after the earthquake, as I said. But in way back in the 50s, I was a member of a literary movement called The Beats. And I was a younger beat poet. And I went to Mexico in 1957 with a number of younger beat poets. We were much younger than the Jack Kerouacs and the Allen Ginsbergs. We were about 15, well, not so much younger than Allen, but certainly than Kerouac and Burroughs. We were about 15 years younger. But we had contact with them in New York. I come from the village. I was born in the village, and my contact was always with poets and artists. And came to Mexico in 1957, returned in 1958, and I didn't go on the road. I mean, all the beats were always on the road. I came and stayed. And I lived for 7 years in a small indigenous village in the mountains of Michoacán. And truly, you know, I've been very close to the Zapatista movement during the last 16 years, I could have not been close to the Zapatista movement if I hadn't spent so many years living in an indigenous community and understanding the dynamic of indigenous life in rural Mexico.
And you spoke about the Mexican Revolution 100 years ago. 100 years before that, 1810, the War of Liberation from Spain.
Right.
Every 100 years, what's in store for 2010?
Well, it seems that the Mexican metabolism kind of explodes in social conflict on the 10th year of the century, 1810, 1910, 2010. Will the revolution come again? I'm not the only one concerned with this. The Wall Street Journal ran an article on January 15th asking the same question. Their sense was that it wasn't going to happen. Objectively, at this moment, Mexico is overripe for social upheaval. The best social economists are telling us that 4 out of every 10 workers who had a job don't have a job now. That's 40% unemployment in the formal sector. And millions of Mexicans have never had a job. They've always just sold in the street. The situation in the countryside, I think, is very dangerous. The great influx of NAFTA corn, 8 to 10 million tons a year, 60% of it genetically modified corn, which is attacking 300 species of native corn. Corn is, you know, corn comes from Mexico 8,000 years ago. That influx of corn had, by the 10th anniversary of NAFTA in 2004, according to the Carnegie Endowment, had put 1.8 million farmers off their land that could no longer compete in the internal economy. Each farmer has 5 in his family, so we're talking about 10 million people no longer on the land. And these are figures from 2004. And generally, the movement has been to the north, to come to El Norte and cross the border and find work. Well, you can't cross the border now. It costs you $5,000 to hire a coyote. There's no guarantee that a coyote will get you across the border, and your family will be pursued by the people smugglers for the rest of their lives to pay this up. And so that safety valve, which has traditionally been the way that younger Mexicans have been able to get out of this very difficult situation, is now closed down. And it's a very much of a pressure cooker situation. Whether there are subjective forces to move in 2010 against the government is another question. And it takes, I think, a pretty deep analysis to figure out who's out there and who's not. Armed groups are generally not very demonstrative of what they have until they're ready to move.
John Ross, very quickly, because Congressman Grijalva is waiting in Washington, D.C., to talk about the immigration laws, this draconian law that has just been passed in Arizona. But the effects of the immigration laws and the war on drugs.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, I always assume these are hot-button issues in the U.S. press, immigration and drugs. The Washington uses these issues to pressure Mexico to win concessions. And they're not necessarily concessions in terms of the drug war or immigration at all. They look at security and they look at economy and basically energy. No. Washington wants to see Mexico privatize its oil industry, Pemex. And so they utilize this pressure that comes from immigration, comes from the drug war, in order to win those concessions. Washington wants greater control over Mexico's security apparatus. So they use things like the ASPAN, the Security and Prosperity Agreement, to be able to, which would integrate security forces throughout the entire continent under Washington's control. They use things like the North Command, which now penetrates Mexico's airspace because Mexico has been declared the southern security perimeter of the United States. So those are the two aims of Washington at this point, to gain control over the Mexican security apparatus and the privatization of Pemex. And all of this Mexico bashing that comes out of immigration and comes out of the drug war is really directed at that. And that's how the White House has operated in Mexico as long as I've been there and much longer than I've been there.
John Ross, I want to thank you very much for being with us. He is the author of El Monstruo, Dread and Redemption in Mexico City. He's on a book tour in the United States. He'll be at the Harvard Coop in Cambridge, and then he's on to the David Rockefeller Center on Latin American Studies. You can go to our website. We'll link to his tour at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
As part of our year-long 50th anniversary celebration, WBAI invites listeners to submit a design for a WBAI 50th anniversary t-shirt. If you want to design a t-shirt, send your sample to t-shirt@wbai.org. That's the letter T, shirt at wbai.org. Or mail to WBAI, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 1005. Attention, t-shirt. The deadline is April 30th. Please hurry. Summer's coming, and we all need something to wear.
Hello, I'm Zamira. You're listening to WBAI in New York City. Me encanta Nueva York.
Truth and Rights by Thievery Corporation. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkadous.
Outrage is growing over the passage of a controversial new measure in Arizona that forces police officers to determine the immigration status of someone they suspect of being an undocumented immigrant. Republican Governor Jan Brewer signed the bill on Friday following its approval in the state legislature earlier in the week. Opponents call it the harshest anti-immigrant measure in the country and a license for racial profiling. Shortly after adding her signature, Brewer said she thought the measure is, quote, what's best for Arizona. At the White House, President Obama denounced the bill and suggested the federal government could intervene.
Indeed, our failure to act responsibly at the federal level will only open the door to irresponsibility by others. And that includes, for example, the recent efforts in Arizona, which threatened to undermine basic notions of fairness that we cherish as Americans, as well as the trust between police and their communities that is so crucial to keeping us safe. In fact, I've instructed members of my administration to closely monitor the situation and examine the civil rights and other implications of this legislation. But if we continue to fail to act at a federal level, we will continue to see misguided efforts opening up around the country.
Well, for more on this bill, Arizona Democratic Congressmember Raul Grijalva joins us from Capitol Hill. At a protest this weekend, Congressman Grijalva urged federal non-cooperation with the new law. Welcome to Democracy Now! What exactly do you mean, Congressman Grijalva, federal non-cooperation?
Well, first of all, I think I'm very appreciative. Many of us are very appreciative of the president's comments right upon the signature of this legislation to look at the civil rights and the constitutional implications, which we feel that this legislation is patently unconstitutional. What we feel, the point about non-cooperation is the next step. You know, immigration is a federal law. And if we are asking the president for him not to cooperate in the implementation of this law through Homeland Security, through Border Patrol, through detention, and a non-cooperative stance by the United States government and the federal agencies would render much of this legislation moot and ineffective.
And Congressmember Grijalva, can you explain exactly what does this law do?
Well, it's a license to racially profile. It creates a second-class status for primarily Latinos and people of color in the state of Arizona. And what it does is it says to local law enforcement, you now have the power to unreasonable suspicion based on primarily, and somebody said based on appearance, to stop, demand papers, demand citizenship, demand information, and if that person does not have it with them, then that person is then arrested and faces up to $500 fine for not having the proper documentation with he or she. The other part, there's other parts that another legislation, which is to require school teachers to become immigration officers and keep a list of potentially undocumented kids, for schools to keep data on potentially undocumented children in their schools, another clear violation of federal protection. But this is, you know, Arizona's been the peach petri dish for these kinds of harsh, racist initiatives. Our border is practically militarized. The pincher effect of forcing people into the desert and to Arizona to cross has been going on since 1994. The National Guard on the border, now it's being asked for again. All those have happened in Arizona, and this harsh legislation is another example. I don't think it's a coincidence. It's been a part of a national strategy. What you can get away with in Arizona then becomes the harbinger for other things in other states. It is a very dangerous precedent. We believe it's unconstitutional, and it has to be fought at a political, legal, and an economic level.
Do you support an economic boycott of Arizona, of your state, Congressman Grijalva?
Yeah, I support some very targeted economic sanctions on the state of Arizona. We will be asking national organizations, civic, religious, political organizations that have not to have conferences and conventions in the state of Arizona, that there has to be an economic consequence to this action and to this legislation. And good organizations across this country, decent organizations that agree with us as this bill is patently racist, that it is unconstitutional, it is harsh, it's unjust, that they should refrain from bringing their business to the state. It's very targeted on conventions, and it's very targeted on national conferences that would come to the state. But when Jan Brewer signed it, she sent this the state of Arizona into an economic black hole that one convention not coming to Arizona is minuscule compared to her signature. Tourism is going to suffer. Import-export is going to suffer. A potential loss of up to $700 million tax dollars from immigrants that work in the state. With her signature, she's caused an already distressed economy in Arizona to sink deeper and deeper into a hole.
And your office has received some threats, some death threats. You were forced to close your Tucson office, is that correct?
Yeah, we closed it last Friday. The threats became particularly dangerous. Federal agencies responded, police agencies. We understand that the person that made the threats is being questioned, and we'll see what happens with that. But, you know, it was one of those discretion being the better part of valor. I know most of these are idle threats, and we tend to ignore them. But these were particularly vile, and you know, people that come to our offices in Arizona for services and the good people that work in our offices, you know, sometimes it's better to err on the side of caution, and that's what we did.
I'm curious, Congressman Grijalva, what do police in Arizona feel about this law? This means also a lot more work for them.
There has been, other than Sheriff Arpaio, who helped cheerlead this law in Maricopa County, the sheriff in Santa Cruz County that's on the border has publicly, before the vote and even now, opposed it. Sheriff Estrada, the sheriff of Pima County, has opposed it. Police chiefs have opposed it. And rank-and-file police officers, in my conversations with them, they feel that they have just been handcuffed, for lack of a better expression, in being able to do the kinds of intelligence community work that is required and to get the public to come forth in order to keep some of the neighborhoods safe. They feel this is now an additional impediment and a barrier on trust that they need very desperately to do their job.
Well, while the passage of the new law in Arizona has been widely decried, the number of programs involving collaboration between ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and local and state police across the nation is continuing to grow. Today, the National Day Laborer Network, the Immigrant Justice Clinic of the Benjamin Cardozo Law School, and the Center for Constitutional Rights are filing a lawsuit demanding records related to ICE's little-known Secure Communities program. The program further embroils local and state law enforcement agencies in federal immigration enforcement and is already operating in 168 jurisdictions in 20 states.
Advocates warn that more agreements are anticipated in the coming days and say secure communities require police to run individual fingerprints through multiple databases upon arrest, even if no charges are brought, and regardless of how minor the charges are. In addition to Congressman Grijalva, are joined by the person at the Center for Constitutional Rights in Washington, D.C., who is taking on this case, Sunita Patel, staff attorney at CCR. Welcome to Democracy Now! What is the story here, Sunita?
Thank you for having me. First, the story here is that Secure Communities is very similar to 287G and Criminal Alien Program, both of which have been overwhelmingly criticized in the public, in the media, and even by the government itself. What we see in Arizona is a culmination of these types of programs where immigration duties are divested to local law enforcement agencies, and they really must be stopped. Today, we have filed a FOIA lawsuit demanding information and records related to Secure Communities and its relationship to these other programs. Also today, there is the launch of a national coordinated week of action called Uncovering the Truth around local law enforcement and ICE collaboration efforts. There will be events in several cities. I think we're up to 10 or 11 cities, with different types of actions, community education events, releases of reports. We really hope that we can raise the profile of these disastrous and dangerous programs.
And can you explain a little more about what the Secure Communities program actually does? How does it further link local law enforcement with federal immigration policy?
Well, what it does is it allows the local law enforcement agencies to check not only the FBI databases, which they've traditionally always done. It also allows them to sync up with immigration databases, which are notoriously unreliable because of errors with data entry, because they just have incorrect information on citizenship status. And so what happens is you have, in the first year, we had 1 million people go through the system. Of those, 5,900 were, about 5,900 were U.S. citizens, and there were thousands and thousands of green card holders that were put through the program. And so what happens is you go through this program, then ICE is contacted, and they may authorize the law enforcement agency to issue what's called a detainer and prevent the release of the individual. And so you have this very broad net being cast, and the program is set to be in every state by 2011 and in every jail by 2013. And even though this is an enormous program, there's very little known publicly about it. There's very little available to all of us. And so that is why CCR and Endelin and Cardozo Law Clinic decided to file suit to get this information. There's an urgent need for information related to this program so that law enforcement agencies and local government officials can make the right choices and make the right decisions about the program.
Let me bring Congressmember Grijalvo back into this in the Capitol Rotunda. Going bigger to federal immigration reform, you pushed hard to include a public option. Progressives did not get any concession there from President Obama. What do you expect to see from him here?
Well, you know, what happened in Arizona should be an urgency, and I want to tell the people at the center that the FOIA request is very important. We've been focused on 287G and the abuses there, and I think this information will be critical to finally analyzing what the real role is with regard to immigration enforcement in the states and in local communities. We have to comprehensive of immigration reform. We have to undo this law in Arizona. They're linked, but they're not mutual in the sense that one fight and another fight. What I expect is comprehensive reform. And if it continues to be a discussion in which the primary focus is going to be enforcement, security, and no real path to legalization, which is critical to comprehensive reform to deal with the undocumented that are here, then I think we're going to be spinning our wheels. And we're talking about not getting the public option in health care, I think it's a great comparison, Amy, in the sense that if there is no path to legalization that begins to deal with the reality of people here, then I think that we're going to be spinning our wheels. We're going to end up with something that is watered down, that it will not deal with the problem that we're having in Arizona and won't deal with the problem we're having in communities across this nation.
Congressmember Rogahava, thank you very much for joining us from the Capitol Rotunda, co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and Sunita Patel, staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights, also joining us from D.C. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hunter Gadu, Sarah Monte, Angelique Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Peter Curry, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Karen Renucci, Nick Gilla, Hugh Grant, Samantha Chambly, Jessel Noor, John Gerberg, Vesta Godars. I will be speaking in Eau Claire, Wisconsin on Wednesday. Thursday night, Stanford University. Friday night, University of California, Davis. On Saturday, I can't even remember where I'll be. On Saturday, I'll be at in San Francisco, and on Sunday, speaking here in New York City. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for all the details of the tour and our sign up for Twitter there and read our transcripts and go to our video and audio podcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Shrifa Dokuduce. Thanks for joining us.
This is Howard Jordan from the Jordan Journal, and as many of you know, some of you have told me, Howard, why do you people keep pitching so often? Well, we've got a solution for you here. It's by getting in early and making a pledge to the station by going to WBAI.org. We will shorten our time considerably. You'll be able to listen to more of our programming, and everybody will be happy. It's a win-win scenario. I, as a member of the WBAI family, encourage you to go online and make a pledge to the station, WBAI.org. We're waiting for you to chime in. Support listener-sponsored radio on WBAI.
Hi, we shall be here from Kenya, and you are listening to WBAI.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.